Over the last year, I've traveled throughout the Colorado River Basin recording conversations with dozens of people, many of them old friends, many more new acquaintances. And all of them were prepared to talk about a subject close to their hearts, the water of the Colorado River. I learned that if we include people from the Indian reservations, ranches, farms, villages, towns, and cities throughout the Colorado River watershed and beyond, 25 million of us rely on the Colorado River for water. Much of our nation's produce is grown in great irrigation districts of the lower Colorado River basin. Over 80% of the river waters go to farms, orchards, and alfalfa fields. But the cities of Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Denver, and Albuquerque also rely on Colorado River water and the hydroelectric power that it generates. In past episodes, we've examined the law of the river and many of the predominant Colorado River issues that have come to prevail over the last century. In this episode, we're going to trace the development of the Central Arizona Project. In this story, we'll hear of myriad conflicts between Native Americans and mineral extractors, environmentalists, and politicians. Indeed, this story illustrates how money can make water flow uphill. I'm Jack Leffler, and I'm inviting you to join me as we continue to explore moving waters, the Colorado River, and the West. The Reclamation Act of 1902 resulted in great irrigation projects throughout the arid West. Stuart Udall, who was born in Arizona and who served as Secretary of the Interior during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, shared with me his thoughts regarding the success of Arizona's Salt River Project, which later served as a model for both combining water and power and dam construction in the West and for the Central Arizona Project.
The Salt River Project was not only one of the pioneering Western irrigation projects, but one of the most successful. That dam was completed in 1913. The Salt River Project is an irrigation project. That huge farming area near Mesa, Arizona, and the surrounding area, the farms fed off the canals that came out of the Roosevelt Dam and even on into Phoenix itself and Glendale. Those huge canals were taking this water. These were very productive farms. That was one of the most successful irrigation projects. It also developed hydroelectric power, and it transformed the Phoenix area, the Salt River Project. The early concepts when they first developed Central Arizona Project, the model was the Salt River Project of 1913. We told Congress, I testified many times, Secretary of Interior, that this was going to be based on the success of the Salt River Project, and the water being brought in would be used for farming.
In order to accomplish the Central Arizona Project, an enormous amount of energy would be required to pump water uphill all the way from Lake Havasu on the Colorado River to the central valleys of Arizona. Former Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt revealed a bit of the history of the quest for electricity to power the pumps.
The original idea was that the dams at Marble and Bridge at the upper and lower ends of the Grand Canyon were going to provide the cash register to pull the water up in central Arizona. Once that fight was won, and David Brower really vindicated himself here because that fight resulted in the cancellation of two dams and no substitutes. But there was a substitute. It was a coal-burning power plant on the Colorado Plateau at the Navajo Generating Station at Page.
Attorney Bill Swan, who has practiced river law and knows the human history of the Colorado River, recalls that the time was perfect for the Central Arizona Project to receive congressional support.
Congress was still in the mood of projects, and that was still the thinking of our society, that was the right thing to do, was to build these things. And of course, there was already a lake there, as we've discussed, in the form of Parker Dam and Lake Havasu, because that's where MWD was pumping out to the west, and so Arizona simply put its big pumping system right there into that lake on the eastern shore, and then started building the big, massive canals and pumping plants to central Arizona.
In post-World War II America, Sunbelt cities including Phoenix, San Diego, and Los Angeles were like magnets. House building boomed, and many politicians and developers had their eyes on the Colorado Plateau as a major source of water and energy. Attorney Charles Wilkinson, who is author of the enlightening book Fire on the Plateau, shared with me his very clear insight into what he calls the big buildup.
An omnibus bill began to develop. This was during the big buildup of the Colorado Plateau, the interior part of the watershed, the canyon country, the Red Rock country, the Four Corners area. And the cities that surrounded the Colorado Plateau, an arc from Denver over to Santa Fe and Albuquerque down to El Paso, Phoenix and Tucson, Salt Lake, Las Vegas, the Southern California cities, they all needed to develop like Phoenix. They all had used up their own water supplies, and they weren't going to build coal plants near the cities because they were too dirty. And so the Colorado Plateau, the interior country, which was dry country but still had the biggest river in the Southwest running down through it, and deep canyons, which made for great reservoirs to store water, and big coal deposits and big uranium deposits, the raid was on. It was Indian country, about a third. Most of the rest of it was public lands. And as far as the cities were concerned, they ended their competition. It's not fully appreciated, but that was a key point. They ended their competition, joined together, used Interior as one-stop shopping because Interior had control over both the public lands and the Indian lands and effectively the river itself. And the big buildup was one of the, if not the, largest peacetime industrial buildup in the history of the world between about 1955 and 75.
William DeBuis, author of Salt Dreams and Seeing Things Whole, The Essential John Wesley Powell, heartily agrees with Charles Wilkinson in his assessment.
I think Charles Wilkinson in the book over there on your shelf conceptualized things exactly right, that Glen Canyon is the linchpin of the big buildup, the big post-war buildup, and its power production made possible metastasis of Phoenix. Its water led in all kinds of different ways to all kinds of different things. And if it weren't for Glen Canyon, the Sunbelt phenomenon would not have taken place, not the way it did.
Well, Phoenix has ended up doing what Southern California did. The land was more valuable for developing subdivisions, and this enormous growth of Phoenix trying to be another Los Angeles. The farmers sold out and they tore down the citrus groves and cotton fields, and you see now this huge glob of urban sprawl. Well, by the time the project was finished, it was so costly the farmers couldn't afford the water, and the water primary use now is for urban use, and it may end up rescuing Tucson, which has grown too far and too fast. The idea of this huge water project, pumping the water in over the hills from the Colorado River, was in itself a huge venture, and we sold it to Congress and the country as a way to preserve this very productive agricultural land. But now the water is there and the aqueducts are available. It's costly water. It's much more costly than anybody imagined, and we certainly misled Congress, in my opinion, on this. So the cities are going to buy the water ultimately, and they'll have to pay for the project.
The cost of the Central Arizona Project came in around $5 billion. Many years ago, David Brower told me that early on, he had major misgivings about the Central Arizona Project.
I think we foresaw that way back in the early 50s, that this was just a ploy to get water sensibly for agricultural use, but to switch it to domestic use and to industrial use as soon as they could get their hands on it. They were getting it with an enormous subsidy. Back in these old days, I did a lot of calculating. By the time you put the interest costs in, normal interest costs, that the government was paying for the money and was not collecting from the farmers, you found it a huge subsidy per acre to get the water on it. But I know it is frightfully expensive. And we could count on the developers getting hold of the water one way or the other. I didn't know the speed with which they were going to do it in the Sun Belt in Arizona and everywhere else where people started to move because they liked to stay warm.
For many years, Charles Wilkinson worked with the Native American Rights Fund, whose legal staff worked closely with Hopi and Navajo Indians to thwart the strip mining of coal on land sacred to both tribes by the Peabody Coal Company of East St. Louis. His passion on behalf of his Hopi and Navajo friends is enduring.
You've got to have the CAP. And that was not only non-negotiable, but non-discussable. That means you had to have another power source. And the quote, logical place, as indisputable really as it originally was simply to dam the Grand Canyon, now the simple solution was the great world-class coal deposit under Black Mesa. Black Mesa had obstacles that should have been as obvious and as important as the distance and the gradient of the CAP itself, but they weren't. What the obstacles should have been but weren't were that this is the Hopi's ancestral land, a deeply traditional tribe in one of the most remote areas in the lower 48, living in their own way and deeply connected to Black Mesa. It is a very complicated matter to scour out the coal bed and create one of the largest, if not the largest, coal mining facility in the world, and then send the coal to two different power plants. One, the Mojave over in Nevada, would be used for electricity generally. The coal would be shipped also north to Page, where Navajo Generating Station would be built to provide the electricity for the CAP, which was far to the south. But with the power grid that had been built up during the big buildup, that was of no consequence. That, quote, simple formula, use Black Mesa coal, ship it north to Navajo Generating Station, use that electricity for the CAP, should have been profoundly complicated for us, because you're tearing up Hopi land, you're tearing up old villages, sacred sites, you're then sending it to a coal-fired power plant that was going to foul the skies, the Hopi skies, and everyone else's skies. It got even more tangled and even more dark, because of the way that the Hopi lease with Peabody Coal was negotiated.
Former Hopi tribal chairman Vernon Masayasva was a young man when giant earth movers began to strip mine Black Mesa. He revealed to me something of the dark side of the so-called contract negotiated by John Boyden, who then served as the general counsel for the tribe.
Our attorney, John Boyden, played this little game of pretending to have us involved. But as we learned later on, everything was already pretty much set. Our attorneys was working with the government, with the power companies, and they were going to mine the coal. And so Mr. Boyden, who is now dead, up front said, I am here in behalf of Peabody Coal Company. He was at the same time, had just negotiated a lease with Peabody, and he was our general counsel.
The Hopi's lawyer in the mid-60s, he'd been their lawyer since the late 40s and would die in 81, was John Boyden, a leading Salt Lake City lawyer, widely respected at the time, twice candidate for governor. The lease with Peabody that the Hopi signed in 1966 was a terrible financial transaction for the Hopis. The lease of coal was for below market value. The lease of water was below $2 an acre foot at a time when it was worth $300 an acre foot or more. And there were many, many prerogatives that Peabody received in leasing that coal and extensions of greater lease areas and greater lengths of time to do the mining that Peabody obtained for little or no compensation to the Hopis. It was a terrible transaction. The Hopi should not, if they were going to lease their traditional land, should not have received just a lease of market value. Instead, it should have been way above market value because the Hopi had such leverage. Because the Christmas tree legislation that was going through that was going to benefit the industries of seven different states depended on Black Mesa coal, because the bill couldn't go through without the CAP, and the CAP couldn't go through without this source of electricity to pump the water uphill. And so the Hopi had great leverage, and John Boyden well knew about the big buildup and well knew about the way that the Southwest was booming and the way it had focused in the Colorado Plateau and the way in which the Hopi had so much leverage. But instead of having a highly favorable business deal or even a business deal at, quote, market value, the Hopi had a dreadful business deal. And there'd always been rumors that John Boyden had secretly, in the dark, represented Peabody Coal.
By that time, Southern Cal Edison had a small power plant up at Laughlin, Nevada. So he must have convinced them to upgrade the plant, make it bigger, and he would give them the coal, cheap. It's going to have to go 273 miles. That's when they came out with the idea of slurring the water, grinding up coal, mixing it with pristine water, half-half, and pipe it over in a distance of 273 miles, the long ways to be hauling coal. And to make it cheap, the water was sold for $1.67 an acre foot from a very ancient aquifer geologists call Navajo aquifer. That's where it would come from. The lease does not specify where the water would come from. It also had no limit as to how much can be used. So this kind of left the door open for the mining company to tap into the best water. And the reason for using the best water as opposed to a highly mineralized water, they much prefer to use pristine water. Pristine meaning soft water. It is the best water you can find anywhere in the world. It is 35,000 years old. It was put there during the Ice Age. The company wanted to use this water so it would not corrode their pipelines as fast. Brackish water would do that. And to make it economically feasible, Hopis were forced to subsidize the operation, along with the Navajos. The subsidies came in the form of cheap rate, $1.67. There are no records anywhere where the Hopi tribe has approved the sale of water for $1.67 per acre foot.
John Echohawk is the director of the Native American Rights Fund. He and I have known each other for about 30 years. He told me about the impact the deep wells are having on the Navajo aquifer in the area around Black Mesa.
Peabody always claimed that this water came from an aquifer so deep that it wouldn't really impact the environment around there. And of course, over the 30 years or so that it's been operating, people living there have started to see that there is an impact. Their groundwater is drying up. What Vernon would like to do is to get Peabody to stop doing that and save that aquifer and stop the change in the ecosystem that's going on there by piping water in from Lake Powell for the Peabody Coal Company to operate that slurry pipeline.
The water is now pumped at the rate of 3.3 million gallons per day, which amounts to about 1.3 billion gallons annually.
The Central Arizona Project and its power needs are being taken care of in large part by the development of the Navajo power plant that's fueled by the Black Mesa coal that you and I were working on years ago. Of course, the Central Arizona Project since that time has played and is still playing a key role in the settlement of Indian water rights claims in Central Arizona. Much of the water that comes into Central Arizona through that project has turned out to be too expensive for most people. So the federal government finds itself using this water as part of its contribution to these Indian water rights settlements. Tribes in Central Arizona are ending up with these waters coming from the Central Arizona Project to settle out its Indian water rights claims. So it's really strange how all that has developed over these years.
Stuart Udall told me something of the Winters Doctrine, which is now nearly a century old and is vital to the preservation of Indian water rights.
As a result of the Reclamation Act, which was a broad act covering the West, you immediately encountered Indian water rights. In a case in Montana, the Supreme Court handed down what's called the Winters Doctrine, and that said, in effect, that when Indian reservations were created, that the law assumed that they would have sufficient water for whatever needs they had then or in the future in their little river basin or river system. That, of course, was a godsend to Indians. Not much was done to implement it, but it's been there. And that doctrine was, I can tell you, in the 1960s when I was there, we saw it as giving us authority to demand that Indian water rights be defined and protected and that Indian projects be pushed forward. We didn't do enough. But that one lawsuit is in many ways more important than the law of the river.
Norris Hundley lives in Santa Barbara, and as we talked, we gazed out his living room window to see the distant horizon of the Pacific Ocean. Norris has devoted much of his life to the study of water and writing about the Colorado River. In a most informative conversation, he shared with me a wonderful irony resulting from the historic 1963 Supreme Court decision in Arizona versus California.
Indians began to assert their rights for Colorado River water. Though Arizona versus California, that Supreme Court decision in 63 said Arizona can have its 2.8 million acre feet plus all the water in its tributaries. But despite it says Arizona versus California in the title, the Indians were the ones who got a significant boost in this decision. The courts were talking specifically about 5 reservations in the lower basin, but there are 25 reservations in the lower basin, and the court made its ruling in such a way as that this decision would apply to all of these reservations. The court said, hey, there's an Indian water right, and it's a right to all the water that they can use to develop their reservation in terms of agriculture. And there's no use greater than agriculture of water, with one exception, a nuclear power plant. And some of the Indians have talked about building a nuclear power plant from time to time. And what is the total amount of the Indian water right? Well, they're still fighting it out. There's still hearings being held in courts. And when the Indians get the legal title to the water, they have legal water, paper water, but they don't have any funds to develop a project. And sometimes, because they don't have the funds from Congress or anywhere to do anything, will lease their water, which, of course, doesn't do anything to maintain a sense of a reservation homeland.
Camilas Lopez is a Tohono O'odham Indian, born and raised in the Sonoran Desert, where water is scarce. He's a lore master for his people, whose culture has evolved in this arid landscape, and for whom life-giving water is sacred. The mythic structure of the Tohono O'odham is rich with metaphor. Camilas has shared with me some stories and songs that reveal something of the spirit of place.
In the culture, the frogs are they're medicine people. They bring rain. A sign of a frog is a good sign because, you know, that means rain. In the desert culture where you live, it's hot and, you know, you see frog, that's a sign of it's rain, gonna rain, or rain has been here. And so it's always been where the frogs are highly regarded for bringing rain or for being great medicine for rain. They talk about the sacred mountain, and you know what, all mountains are sacred, but all of them have their own stories. And the belief in the O'odham is that the mountains make the clouds. If you're sitting under a mountain, or even if you're far away, and the clouds are coming over, it looks like the mountains are making the clouds, and they're stirring them into the air. Mountain, in the O'odham belief, every mountain makes clouds. So in this song, it's talking about the Frog Mountain, Baba the Duak.
The Colorado River Indian tribes include Mojave, Chemehueve, and since the 1940s and 50s, some Hopi and Navajo Indians. Their collective reservation lies along the banks of the Colorado River. They irrigate their farmlands with river water. Gary Hansen is an attorney who works with the Colorado River Indian tribes.
Basically, I'm responsible for the management of the tribe's water resources and also their irrigation system. And they irrigate about 80,000 acres of land, most of it in Arizona. The Colorado River Indian Tribes has a large present perfected right in the Colorado River. They're allocated 717,148 acre feet. They have the perfected right, which was given to them through the adjudication of the water rights by the U.S. Supreme Court. Their rights were developed and perfected because of the Winters Doctrine, which gave them the ability to get water for the amount of irrigable acres that are on their reservation, and they have about 110,000 acres of land that could be irrigated, and they irrigate about 80,000 of that. Where we are right here is a major effort regarding traditional values, because the tribes put a great value on the river and the natural environment that has established itself along the river. And this project here is an effort to turn back the clock and establish more of a natural environment back the way it used to be. They have a very close tie to the habitat that has developed along the river.
In 1922, when the Colorado River Compact was enacted, Nevada had only a meager human population. Thus, it was awarded a modest allocation of 300,000 acre feet of Colorado River water. Today, the area around Las Vegas is the fastest growing urban center in America. Its waters come from Lake Mead, and much of the electricity that powers the lighting arrangements of the casinos comes from a nearby generating station that burns coal slurried through a 273 mile long pipeline from Black Mesa in Arizona. Patricia Mulroy is the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. She is a clear-thinking realist and one of the most enlightened of the so-called Colorado River water buffaloes.
When you look at it in the macroeconomic sense, we take in the state of Nevada 8% of the water resources in Southern Nevada and invest it in the industry that gives us a 75% gross return, 75% of the gross proceeds for the state of Nevada. That's not a bad investment. You need a portion of your water to sustain human life. You need a portion of your water for economic uses, and you need a portion of your water for environmental uses. Well, if you can take a mere 8% of your overall water supply and get a 75% return on that investment, that's not a bad investment. And the hotel industry has been extremely responsive. I mean, all those water features that you see, they've done one of two things. The board 10 years ago enacted some real stringent rules about water features. You go to the basement of the Treasure Island, you'll find a full-fledged wastewater treatment plant. It captures all the water, it treats it, and that's what you see in those water features. Those that haven't done that, in order to build the water feature, they had to go out and they had to pay for 1.5 times the amount of water they're going to use through conservation elsewhere. It works. They pay some very large water bills. Most of the water is used in the aggregate by residential users. I, as an individual user, have a hard time seeing myself part of that larger whole, but that's who uses the water. It's people. There's a lot of talk always about Las Vegas as this fast-growing, out-of-control town. If you look at it historically, we're just the latest one. It's just moving up the river basin. The migration to the west has not stopped. It's just that right now, Las Vegas is the place where everybody comes. I think through the creation of the authority, we have set a foundation that will provide sane and sensible solutions. Managing the water resources, the community has really come together. They appreciate the need to conserve. Creating a sense of conservation by changing the ethic of an urban area as opposed to responding to a drought is a challenge. We'll get there. We'll get to where we need to be.
Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, is a production of the Arizona Humanities Council, Executive Director Dan Schilling. Our series is presented by the Humanities Councils and Endowments of Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Funding was provided by the Ford Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The project director is Nancy Dallette. The executive producer is Marcos Martinez. Our production assistant is Celestia Peregrina Leffler. Our theme was performed by Carl Bernstein. The series was produced in its entirety by Jack Leffler in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, thank you for listening.